One of the more difficult things you can get involved with as an HR executive is transformation. When you are coming into a organization that is in a turnaround process, there is an incredible amount of stress and pressure and ultimately coordination that needs to happen for that turnaround to be successful. And a lot of that falls on the people team. In today's episode, I'm really excited to sit down with the Chief People Officer of Mozilla, Michael D'Angelo. Michael has a deep HR background that spans companies including Merck, Microsoft, Pinterest, Google, PepsiCo, and currently Mozilla. And he is in an HR transformation situation there. And so we're going to talk about his path, that journey to Mozilla, and really what are some of the key elements that HR executives need to think of when they're in HR transformation situations. We'll be right back with that conversation after a brief word from our sponsor. 21st Century HR is a podcast exploring how to build better businesses through modern people practices and approaches. It's brought to you by my firm, Amplify. Amplify provides HR executive search and strategic consulting services that help companies build better organizations. From employer brand development and execution to global talent strategies, Amplify develops custom solutions that help clients from Hootsuite to SpaceX optimize their recruiting capabilities. Amplify also hosts a new community for HR leaders called the Ecosystem. The Ecosystem was designed to bring modern HR leaders around the world together to share ideas, inspiration, and support. Learn more at amplifytalent.com. Hey everyone, welcome to the 21st Century Podcast. I'm your host, Lars Schmidt, and I am thrilled to be joined today by the Chief People Officer for Mozilla, Michael D'Angelo. Michael and I are going to get into a range of topics that spans his both deep and broad HR career, including some meaty areas like turnaround and HR transformation. So, Michael, thanks so much for coming on the show. If you wouldn't mind, why don't you give listeners a brief introduction on you?
Hey, Lars. It's great to be here. Thank you for having me. Just as background, I've been in the people space for probably 20 years and live in San Francisco. And my current role is with Mozilla as Chief People Officer, and have had, a blessed career working across a lot of different industries and different great companies. So happy to share. And the caveat I would give up front is if you talk to 50 people like me, they'll tell you different things. So I'll give you my point of view and sort of what I've learned over the last 20 years.
Yeah, and to be fair, with your background, I don't know if there are 50 people like you, but point taken. I think, you know, when you look across your experience, it's a fascinating lineage of companies that you've worked at, spanning, you know, Merck, Microsoft, PepsiCo, Google, Pinterest, and currently Mozilla. And there's a lot of rich learnings, I'm sure, in that background that we can dig into. But before we even go there, what drew you to HR to begin with?
Like most people, I think in my age group, I came around it through the side as opposed to like got into the discipline intentionally. But I grew up in New Jersey, and half of the population in New Jersey wanted to grow up and be a lawyer. And I was in that half. So I worked actually through undergrad. I went to school at night and I was a paralegal in employment law. And I had gone through the process of LSAT, applying to law school, and was actually set to go. And 1 month before I started, there was something fundamental that I knew practicing law was not going to be interesting to me. And largely because I worked with a lot of lawyers and I saw a lot of work over 5 years. But I sort of had a crisis, and I was 22 years old, and I didn't know exactly what I was going to do. But I worked in employment law, and I had worked with a lot of HR folks. And there was one I was close with, and I talked with her, and I said, look, I don't know what I'd want to do. And she said, well, have you considered HR? I think because she worked with me quite a bit. She had just been promoted. She said, I've got a recruiter opening if you'd be interested. I actually think you'd be good in HR. And I said, yeah, I really like the issues that we talk about. And I like the thought of, you know, how do you make leaders effective? How do you make people effective? So I tried it out and I loved it. And after that, they said, well, if you want to progress in this company, you'll need to go to get your grad degree. And I did that. And once I saw the curriculum, I really fell in love with the discipline. And it's luckily I got into it because I still have no idea what I'd be doing if it wasn't for the people function.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I think when you, and I would, you know, not having your resume in front of me, but I think we've, you know, we've probably started our careers around the same time. I think it's a very common story for people that began their careers then that you kind of, again, that the side path in, it wasn't necessarily the career that it is now. And I think that's one of the things that's exciting about the field today is that I think it has matured in some really interesting ways where now I think as I, you know, talk to younger talent and people just starting their careers, I think it's a much more of a conscious and deliberate choice to get into the field. And there's also the breadth of types of opportunities that exist today are so much more robust than they were, you know, back in the day.
Yeah, totally agree. And I love that I talk with a lot of you know, junior talent who are looking to get into the field and they're super thoughtful about it, even in undergrad, and they're thinking, taking courses and thinking longer term about it. And that's just, it's just greatness for the function.
Yeah. And so, you know, from your vantage point, you know, the CHRO role, I'm sorry, the CHRO role has evolved, you know, quite a bit over the last 10 years. And obviously during that time, you've had HR executive roles at, you know, places like Pinterest and Google and PepsiCo, and obviously now your role at Mozilla. When you think of how that position has evolved over the last decade, what things stand out to you? How is it different today than it was 10 years ago?
Yeah, I think it's much more complicated now than it was when I first started in more senior roles. I think the business environment is much more complicated. So it's constantly moving. The pace of change is super fast, much faster than I remember 10 years ago. There's a lot of consolidation in particular companies. So with some big, like for big tech, for example, or some other players in other industries, and the difficulty of companies trying to compete and to stand out and differentiate is really fast, is changing very quickly, and you have to continue to differentiate. So there's complexity there. And for tech, when I spent half my career in tech, you're just constantly being disrupted. So it's churny. Like it is there's a lot more stress in the system for people and everyone from top to bottom in an org. And that's a big challenge. So I think I'll say CPO, I like the people's as opposed to the HR, so I'll say chief people officer. We worry about capabilities a lot more now. Like, do you have the capabilities to compete, not just in the current model, business model you have, but the next one that you're planning on, because you're going to get disrupted. So that's different. And then there's a really basic one that I don't think we talk about a lot, but the evolution of sort of real time and viral media makes the stakes much higher now than 10 years ago. So your ability to part of our role is to mitigate risk and to manage that for an organization. And it's not quite this dramatic, but most of us are one tweet away from really bad brand damage. And that lasts for a long time because things stay out on the internet. And 10 years ago, you mostly just worried about how do I make sure we take care of our people? How do we make sure they feel like it's a strong and it's an inclusive culture? And now that stuff gets out, and we see so many of our peers or companies who go sideways based on one event. And sometimes it's merited where they just didn't invest there. And sometimes it's a mistake, and mistakes happen, but there's a real internal and external impact we need to think through now in the current media environment.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, your point around media, there's a real velocity to which things can spread. Right. And in some cases before the story is really developed. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there may be a partial element of a story and then that goes viral. But that's not the complete picture. And then even if the full picture comes out and it kind of undoes, it kind of right sizes the story, the damage is already done. You can't necessarily, that doesn't go away. Even I think at a later point when you correct that story, and that's a really complicated environment to be in, particularly in a role like yours. And I think to your point earlier as well around kind of CPO versus CHRO, it's fascinating because I think the title CPO tends to certainly be common in technology companies and technology organization. And I think traditional organizations in large part still have a CHRO, but I recorded a podcast a couple months back with MasterCard's CPO, Michael Fraccaro, and he had just gone through a transformation of his own title from CHRO to CPO for the reasons you mentioned. And his team was going through a reinvention. And it was fascinating to me because I think that was one of the first, what I would consider kind of traditional organizations that was starting to follow that path as well.
Yeah, that's great. No, I think they're small things, but I do think our job in particular, it's important that we never lose sight of the fact that you're there to support people and you're there to support the business, but you have the unique responsibility of making sure there's an inclusive and a supportive culture. And the more senior you get, it's very easy to get pulled away from that because most of your interface can just be with the executive team. But yep. We try to spend a lot of time focusing on what's happening at any level within the organization. And that's about people.
Yeah. And one of the things I'm curious to get your perspective on, being that you've been in kind of, large global HR leadership roles in a mix of tech and non-tech industries, how would you compare and contrast those two? What's different about leading HR functions in technical companies versus non-technical companies?
This is a cop-out, but they're different and the same yeah. in a lot of ways.
Well, yeah, let's dig into both.
The older you get like me, the more you see truth. Like the truth is very broad
right.
in how people practices are done. But the first thing I would say is for anyone who's listening who wants to be a CPO, I would encourage people to to spend a lot of time in different industries. And I had a great mentor who's still a mentor to me from my early days at Merck. And he's pretty insistent. He said, you need to see different businesses. You need to get into consumer products. You need to see tech. That will make you a better business practitioner. And when you are that, then you're better able to create people solutions that sort of meet business needs. But I still feel like I don't always feel tech, honestly. Like I feel more like heavy manufacturing and consumer products, where you're working with not just technical people, but people who don't really have a career, but they have a job, and I worked with a lot of blue collar, and I grew up blue collar. Actually, my dad was an electrician. So in some ways I feel more comfortable with blue collar folks. And I've worked with a lot of unions, probably half my career. And you just, that also gives you a sense of people and getting connected and what's it really like to do that person's job. So I think you get that more in some of the more traditional non-tech companies than in tech. I think that's goodness. That's really good if you build that into your DNA early in your career. And I think the non-tech, just because the length of time that companies like heavy manufacturing and CPG have been out, they've been doing this for 100 years. So, yeah. and literally, like they're much more disciplined and steeped in OD and sort of the science behind a lot of what we do in IO psychology. And they've been a partner to the business for a lot longer than tech has. The discipline in tech is still nascent. So right. I think you're from a training perspective and development, I would encourage people, like if you're going to do, you're going to go into the function, I would go into some of those other companies first and get where there's still, you're going to learn a lot of progressive things, and you're going to have P&L responsibility to some extent because you're working directly with a business and you learn the fundamentals there, I think better probably than in tech these days. The downside is they're mostly larger companies in non-tech. It's harder to drive change because it just takes longer. Not that they're averse to change, but it just takes longer. But sometimes because they've been doing things for a while, it is harder to change people's minds. So that happens in non-tech, that's one of the downsides.
Right. That makes sense. That's actually a really interesting perspective.
I would just give you like a couple of things. The strengths in tech is you can move super fast. I think people are more open to doing innovative things in the people space and testing. It's just, it is, it tends to be a more open environment. And I would say overall, there's higher tolerance for change just because people's work and the industry changes so much that the DNA is a little bit more change-minded. The downsides are, there's some of the ones that we've, that's been out in media, and it's very clear, like we, in tech, we have not made fast enough progress in D&I, and we're still way behind there. And the one key difference is the seasoning of managers or leaders is always harder in tech, because people are, people move so fast and they're going through promotion tracks so quickly. Often they're not getting the seasoning of what it takes to be a really good manager or leader. And it's not just judgment. It's just going through mistakes and learning and getting the seasoning and sort of having some battles that you've lost and you've learned from.
I think that's a really important point around, you know, kind of L&D and development in tech. Cause I think, and this is, you know, perhaps starting to change. I'm starting to see some companies that are investing more in that area earlier. But for a lot of companies, especially startups that are in hyper growth, you know, they're so focused on recruiting and scale. And on the one side, from a career development standpoint, you know, it's great for employees that are early on because you get to take on a lot more and stretch yourself in ways that, you know, you might not in a more of a traditional organization. The challenge is oftentimes that's not coupled with the training and support to know how to be an effective, you know, manager or whatever the role is. And it happens a lot of times in managers where people are kind of moved into a leadership role, you know, because they don't have a senior individual contributor path. And now they're managing a team and it's their first time doing it. And they've never had any support from the organization on how to be an effective manager. And that can be a recipe for disaster that I think is not that uncommon in tech.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, there is the baseline problem of not doing enough for managers when they first step into the job. And we launched a bunch of those things in Google, and I launched them in Pinterest and in Mozilla. Then there's the problem of the concept of the leadership pipeline just doesn't exist in tech like it does in non-tech, where people, you're very thoughtful about to go to a manager role and learn how to be exceptional at growing managers so you build scale. Then think of a functional leader role and learn the differences there, where you're having to make pretty big trade-offs in what you prioritize. And then going up to enterprise, going up to more of a multiple P&L type approach or enterprise approach. There isn't that career path. So what I see in a lot of leaders, even outside the people function, is they've never done some of this, gone through some of those seasoning steps. And they're going, like the most acute issue is you've got a product manager who has an idea and she starts a company, and then she's forced to go into the CEO spot, and she'd never done any of the steps in between, and not having, let alone the experiences, but the seasoning and learning that comes with those, that's just to a detriment. And that's why I think a lot of the leadership capability issues are there in tech, because we haven't groomed them throughout that path.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And you know, one thing I'm curious about as well, kind of following your background, when you transitioned and from your role at PepsiCo to Google, you know, your first role at Google was as an HR executive over the Europe, Middle East, and Africa region. And curious, for one, was that your first kind of international scoped role and a role where you were based kind of overseas, overseeing a population outside of the U.S.?
It wasn't my first international role. My first job out of grad school was running Comp and Ben for Asia Pacific at Merck. So I spent most of my time over in the region, but I we lived in New Jersey, and my mentor I mentioned before, we were headquartered in New Jersey of all places, but it was a very centralized people function. So, but the first time I lived in the region was in EMEA. But the being the first job out of grad school, it really changed my perspective very early on for having a mindset towards thinking about the people who are doing the work outside of the U.S. and what it's like living on the other side of the phone call at that point, and making sure that they had the tools and the resources they needed and they felt connected, and wherever we could, they felt autonomy. So that was that was one of the most important experiences I got, because I came to be known as sort of the international rep at headquarters for sort of any projects or global things we launched. I was on just about every team because I had that international mindset. And I feel like most of the roles that I brought going forward, I still had an international population and I had to travel, and I kept that with me. So I would also recommend, if anyone's earlier in their career, do something that's at least supporting international, if not overseas, really early.
Yeah, I think that's that, having that exposure to global operations and allowing you to start developing that global mindset early on, I can see how that would be valuable, not, you know, obviously not just in the role at Google, but throughout your career. When you kind of stepped into that position, how did you approach kind of building out your HR, structure, philosophy, approach, et cetera, for those regions at Google's after you'd moved out there?
Yeah. It was a huge transition. Right. And I think first, just as a, it's great for people, especially Americans, because they're so heliocentric. It's great for Americans just to go out and live outside of the US, live where in a place where maybe English isn't the strongest language, and having to learn just how to operate. And that's just goodness for just as a life skill, but also as a people practitioner. The first thing I really learned and sort of focused on is any regional role, that alone is just misleading. Like there's no point of view from EMEA. Like, and this is a joke with some of my friends and in the industry, but if oftentimes you want to go out and get, so what does EMEA think of this? If you're thinking of a global program, what does APAC think of this? And it's very American, because even Europe is not Europe. Even sometimes Germany is not Germany. If you have multiple sites, like, you have to get very local input, and there is no EMEA. There's a collection of 20 different locations that have very different cultures, different laws, different perspectives on people and business. So the first thing I did was just, I talked with a lot of folks on the ground in each of the different sites, and I had people on the ground, who were awesome, and they ran the people function for each of the 20 locations. But I just went out and I talked, and I learned from the site leaders, I learned from people there, what were the gaps, what did they need, and co-developed a lot of the programs that we put in place. And I think in tech that works really well. So if you were looking at, I'll make it up, but we did a manager development program there. What does that need to be? What's different about operating in each of those groups, and what do managers need? And then we would build that and co-develop it with a swath of people who could help provide input there. From a structure side, it was pretty typical structure. I had responsibility for all the people partners. I had dual responsibilities, and there was each of the functional groups had a report into headquarters and also had a report into me. So I treated all the functions as like part of the broader people function. And I had one manager who oversaw people partners. I had someone who oversaw comp and ben and recruiting and on and on. So pretty typical structure. The things that are most important out there is getting local. And especially if you're not from the region, getting really clear with the local labor laws and how, like, which takes a lot of time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, 20 regions, I'd imagine they're all fairly unique and distinct in terms of their own labor laws and approaches and practices and customs. That's there's a tremendous amount of nuance in that, for someone like you kind of in that role where you're overseeing operations across them. So having those boots on the ground, those kind of local resources that can help accelerate your education, I imagine that was invaluable.
Yeah. And you know, I think what it really, it taught me a few things, but one of the clearer ones was you learn how to build for scale, and you're never going to be able to build something individually for 20 different locations with a lot of different needs, but you have to get to, some of your offerings have to build for scale. And at the CPO level, you're constantly making these trade-offs of scale versus individualization. And then which things that you invest in, because everybody has limited resources, even at Google, which ones are going to pay off? And some of that's judgment, but some of it's testing and really talking with leaders about where are your key pain points. And then finding things like, if you improve all managers by 10%, even, you drive a ton of scale into the organization. So those bet, learning how to take those bets and go after scale with limited resources was a key learning. But the other thing that just sticks out to me about being in region is you often have two leaders. You have a functional leader of the region, and then you have a business leader of the region, and then you have a functional leader back in HQ. And I dramatically underestimated the challenge of that, because they couldn't have been more different from in terms of what they think was the most important thing to value from the people function. And that was learning how to manage the triangle of your business leader and a functional leader. And the function could, if you're below a CPO, the function could be the CPO, or it could be just what we want to do across the enterprise versus what the local region wants to do. And spending time up front, if you're in this type of role, really focusing on that relationship between those two leaders. And even if they're 9 time zones away, like making sure you understand how can they come to an agreement on a balance between company and regional. And that was one of the toughest parts of that job, but I learned a ton in it.
Yeah, I think that's a great point for anyone who's listening who, you know, may be considering or in a similar position, because you have, you know, kind of dual stakeholders, if you will, that may not be on the same page in terms of priorities and focus and expected outcomes. And so that can be dicey if you're in the middle of that and don't have that kind of open line of communication, not just with them, but kind of across them as well. So after your role at Google, you returned to the States to join Pinterest as their SVP. And I'm curious, kind of looking back across that experience, what was your proudest accomplishment there?
I feel really good about a lot of things there. And the team was fantastic. Like that was a stellar team across every function. I learned a ton from them. I think they learned from me. So I feel like we, in the 3.5 years I was there, we got a lot out the door, and it was a really big amount of transformation and a growth in the business. I feel like I'm most proud of the D&I diversity and inclusion work we did, because I feel like we're really ahead of the curve in tech in particular, particularly for startups, because most startups, they're just focusing on getting to IPO, building the business, building the engagement loops with users and driving MAU. And for us, I was employee 180. And one of the things I worked on with the leadership team is I had learned from being at bigger companies that the longer you wait to really focus on this, whether that comes in the people that you hire or the types of inclusion practices you put in place, if you wait too long, you've lost. And the big tech companies, for them to do the turnaround from where they're at and the baselines they have, it's really hard to do that. It's almost impossible if you get to like 10,000 people and you're now trying to invest in diversity and build it into your DNA. It's almost impossible. So we started super early. And I think that with all the work that we did there, and by the way, Candace Morgan was my D&I leader, and she's phenomenal. She's just super world class. She deserves a lot of the credit for the progress we made. But the focus that we had on D&I, how it became part of the overall DNA, and then the things that we did to drive representation change over time, and then inclusion change over time, were probably in top decile or top quartile in tech. Probably the crowning achievement, I'd say, is where we were the first company anywhere, I think, of any industry that I know of to publish our D&I goals publicly. And that was before this, even doing goals was really a thing for the whole company. And the coolest thing is we got a shout out from President Obama the week after we did it. And I got a picture from my team that everyone signed, where it was him at the podium talking about it was just a name drop for Pinterest, but it was the culmination of probably 9 months worth of work, and super proud of the team and everything we did there.
Yeah. And when you look back, you know, obviously starting early, I think that's a really important point, because I think once you hit a certain critical mass, it's much harder, to your point, or even impossible in some cases, to really make a significant systemic kind of DNA driven difference in terms of how the company operates. And so obviously starting early is definitely valuable. Are there any other kind of specific kind of tactical practices that, you know, Candace and your team led at Pinterest that you think allowed you to be so successful?
Yeah. There's a lot, and we shared a lot of it. We always open sourced what we were doing and learning. But the first is, it's credit to the CEO, Ben Silberman, and the co-founder, Evan Sharp, because they were strong advocates. And if you don't have that, it's really hard to do this, because there are trade-offs. Like, you will not move as fast as you want to if you take all the things that you should take into account with D&I. Be very easy to just, from a hiring perspective, not focus on it, from inclusion perspective, not focus on it, and move faster. Like, it's, and for a startup to do that, you have to be willing to make that investment. But they both have super strong moral compasses, and they cared about it. And if you have that, you can do a lot. And they cared about it specifically because, first, they would always say it's the right thing to do, but they also agreed with the research that diverse teams create better products because they challenge each other. And I think we've all seen this. If you're in a team that just, they all have the same ideas, it's these conversations on when you're making product decisions or you're making business decisions, they're really easy because everyone's thinking the same way and they're like, yep, let's go do it. And they're fast meetings. But when you've got people who have lots of different experiences and life experiences or backgrounds, you just push and pull on your thinking, and you come up with things that you wouldn't have come up with because you challenge. And that's the type of environment they want it. So that it starts with that. I'd say if you are a CPO and you're in this space, your first job is to get the people team to that, the leadership team to that level, and find the thing that resonates for them. This is why it's important that they feel, and whatever it is, because it's different for different leaders, but you have to start with that, which we had. I also think that leadership team, you know, second thing is important, is they have to be willing to innovate. And we're going to be open to trying different things. And we tried a lot of different things on the recruiting side, from what we did for people who came from underrepresented backgrounds once they got to Pinterest, and the investment that leaders spend in going to ERG types of meetings or meeting with people who might have concerns or have suggestions on things that could help either more broadly at D&I or for particular groups, and that they were very involved in that. And the last thing I'd say which is super important, just to reiterate, if you don't, we started early. I think we started very early. So to build a diverse team from lots of different backgrounds, you have to get to critical mass, because there's something very basic that when you come in to interview, and doesn't matter how much money the company says they spend, if you come in to interview and you walk around and you don't see anyone who looks like you or comes from your background, you've lost. Like, it's they are not going to believe you that you take this seriously. So really focusing on that early, building that as natural DNA and critical mass. If you have more tech women, who it will feel more safe if you're a woman from technical background to come into an organization. If you're from an underrepresented background, it's the same. Like, you want to feel safe, and it's awful to feel like an only. And we talked about this all the time. We didn't want anyone who came into the organization to feel like an only, because that's an awful feeling. And the more you can provide support and people who have shared backgrounds, the faster you'll make progress.
Yeah, that's really good advice. And I think what I'll also do is I will go back through some of the open source work that you've had on Pinterest and include some of those links in the show description. So for listeners that want to dig a little bit more into that, we'll serve that up for you in the show overview. About a little over 2 years ago, you left Pinterest, a role, you know, sounds like you had a lot of fun in and were really passionate about, to join Mozilla as their Chief People Officer. And I'm curious, what what kind of led to that transition for you? What appealed to you about kind of stepping out of a role that you're really engaged in and move into a new position?
There was a few things about Mozilla that really stood out to me, but there's a business transformation that was going on. And Mozilla is an iconic brand. It has been in the industry for 20 years. And when I heard about the role, I was like, I love the brand and I love what it stands for. An open and accessible internet for everyone. And I had been a Firefox user. So the business transformation was unique because they were trying to do something very different. And that's always really good, rich people work, if you can get into a company that is transforming. The mess part was in the people team. So we were not in a good spot. And I would prefer to go into a people team that needs a lot of work. And they had people like hearts in the right place, but the environment wasn't positive at all. The teams did not work well together. They did not have a strong reputation in the company. And that's the type of work that I love. I love to get in and build from the ground up and fix wherever I can. So that was super exciting. Plus, my heart just went out to them because there was so many really good people there who just wanted to be proud of the work they're doing and to have impact. And then the last point is that it's just a very unique point in time in the world for privacy and security and how much focus there is on this and how much bad press there is on tech companies that are not taking this seriously. And that's always been something that has been really important to me. And I knew that this was a really unique point in time for Mozilla to have a say in what's going to happen in the next 10 years in tech. So all of those combined were the big draw.
Yeah. And so, you mentioned kind of being drawn to turnaround roles and sticky role, challenging roles, positions that require you to really re-engineer a lot of the people, processes, and systems. How do you go about doing that, right? Like, as a people executive, when you know the business is going through a pivot and a transformation, you know that the underlying kind of people, processes, and infrastructure requires a lot of refining to support the new direction. As a people executive, how do you go about, like, there's often so much there. Mm-hmm. Right? Like you probably have a whiteboard or whiteboards full of ideas and priorities. Like how do you kind of, assess all the things that need to be done and then prioritize those, based on the resources and the capacity that you have?
Yeah, that's the whole thing. I mean, most of our job, the more senior you get, is about the decisions you make on where you prioritize, and you're not always going to get it right, but I do the same thing for every new role, and I do a listening tour. And I met with my target was 100 one-on-ones, and I had 100 one-on-ones across the organization and talked with every level of employee from all different functions and asked like really basic questions like what's going well with the people function, what's not going well, what would you change if you're in my role, what do you think you would focus on first? And I did that initially just to get a groundswell of, what's the sentiment out there and where are the top priorities? And meeting, it's easy to get that data. The trick is to have enough volume so that you start to see where's the preponderance of the issues. So I had a cohort that's just the leadership team, which is the CEO and his directs. So I knew what their key issues were. Then I looked at individual contributors, what their key issues were, looked at folks who were remote, looked at folks who were outside the US and combined all those. And I saw some themes, like a top five of themes that I thought were showing up the most. And then once you have those, like you start to get, maybe when it's 25% through the listening tour, Lars, I checked in with leadership team. I checked in with my team. Here's what I'm hearing. What is this? Does it resonate? Does it not resonate? These are the people I'm planning to meet with. Who else should I meet with? And then throughout, I did maybe one more check-in and then a final review. And most of that comes down to what is the leadership team and what are you hearing from sort of ICs on what we should prioritize? And then you make a bet and you look at what's most important. And the thing that I've learned in the last couple of roles is get the foundation in place first. And the things that are oftentimes the things that are most important to people are not the cool, shiny projects. It's like, get your people operations in order. And that was one of the key things that we had to do. And I hired a phenomenal leader. And all of my direct reports are all phenomenal. I feel super blessed to work with them. But I hired a phenomenal leader there. I won't won't mention the name because then everyone's gonna go try to get him. But
yes, they will.
He was able to break it down from like and sort of build this thing back up. And if you're not meeting the fundamental needs and using your tools and being responsive to people, you're never gonna make progress. And if your data is wrong, if your you can't get headcount right, you're never gonna make progress. So always over-index on what the clients really need and they're asking for before you start to go with the shiny. And I've been guilty in the past of going after more stuff that you would publish in a PSYOP publication as opposed to really get clear what the business core needs are. So I think the first year we just focused on rebuilding credibility, rebuilding trust from the org. And then we were given the permission to do more things like really go fast at things like capability. And that's how I started it.
Yeah. And I'm glad you raised the point around being really kind of thoughtful and deliberate and not necessarily chasing the shiny things early on. And I think that's a common mistake that people execs make, especially I think, earlier in their career, people that are in that role for maybe the first or second time is, they want to come in and they want to make their mark quickly. Mm-hmm. They want to make an impact. They want to be seen as being impactful. And that bias for action sometimes will have them chase the wrong thing and put energy and cycles into the thing that's not really going to move the needle in terms of, employee engagement and satisfaction and impact. And you find yourself kind of going down that path for a certain period of time. And before you really realize, okay, this isn't really the big thing that I hoped it would be. And so I think it's important to kind of underscore that point that you made around really being, having the listening tour, but really being thoughtful about the priorities that will really have the most impact. And sometimes it's much better to be slow and deliberate and mindful than fast if you're going fast down the wrong lane.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Lars. I would, first, I think people underestimate the amount of time they really have. I think as long as you're clear, like here is my plan. I was very clear with everyone I talked to. I'm going to take 90 days, 100 days, and I'm not going to make any key decisions in that time frame. And you're going to get pressure to make key decisions. Your team's going to be asking you to do things that are like, this has been holding for 6 months or 12 months. But the best thing you can do and explain to your team, if you're the new CPO, is look, it's really important I learn here first. I need to understand before being understood. And I want to get the culture. I want to understand the history. And then I need to understand where the volume is for problems and the things that we need to go fix, because that's what's going to help us make the most progress. And you have to have a mindset of what do the clients first need? You may think that this thing would give you, like this shiny thing would give you the fastest start, but I guarantee if that is not what the clients think is broken, it's going to actually impede your progress. So start with what they're asking you to do, and then once you get credibility there, they're like, okay, this person knows what they're doing. Then they're going to give you the permission to do things that are more progressive.
Yeah, that's really good advice. And I'm curious from your perspective. I mean, obviously you've worked in some really renowned organizations for having progressive and forward-leaning people teams. When you think about this idea of 21st century HR, what does it mean to you? How would you define it?
Yeah, I think we're going to have to be much more business-minded, and even more so in the past, because the work that we do, I've talked about this before, but if you don't, there's two core parts of our role. There is, how do you create a culture that is supportive, that is allows the work to be done really effectively, allows people to feel that they're not an only, they feel included, and they understand that their work has a meaning and a purpose. So there's that culture side of your role, but then there is a business capability side that is critical. And most of us under-index on that. But if you don't if you don't really learn the business, if you don't really learn what drives user growth, what drives engagement for users, how do you make money? And then what levers you need to pull in order to do those things better, that will inhibit your ability to look 2 to 3 years out with the business and say, this is the business we're in now, but what's the business we're going to go to in 2 years? And how do we have the capabilities so that when that starts, we can do that work? And that is the whole thing is going to be, in my opinion, going to be around capabilities, because especially in tech, the industry will just continue to evolve and disrupt. And you will not be supporting the business if you are just working on what they're doing currently. Like, you have to be thinking about where it's going to go. And largely that those capabilities are probably going to be different, whether that you're going to take on a new business model, you're going to shift into subscription or a content model or an enterprise model. All of those things have very different needs from a leadership, from an org dynamic, from how you structure the organization decisions you make. So you constantly have to be thinking of that, because oftentimes the line leaders are not. Maybe your CEO is very progressive and she thinks about that, but she would at the very least need a partner who's helping her think, this is where we need to be 2 years out, which means we have to start now. So if I focused anywhere, I would focus in that space.
Yeah, I think that's such an important point. And to me, I think that's one of the key defining characteristics of a modern CPO. You know, you can't just have the domain expertise within HR and people functions. You have to understand the business. You have to have the business acumen. You have to understand in a lot of ways, to me, the modern CPO role is probably the most complex in the C-suite, because you don't have to just go deep in your own domain. You have to understand the company's, you know, strategic plans. You have to understand the market potential and risks for the industry. You have to understand all the financials. You have to understand the marketing strategy. You have to understand the go-to-market strategy. You know, there's so much that a CPO has to really understand, and not just at a surface level, in addition to going really deep in their own domain, it's so incredibly complex. But again, to your point, it really all kind of comes back to that business acumen. Without that, I don't think you can be successful.
Yeah. Yeah. You and I both have the same point of view. You can never leave your responsibility to your people. Like, you will always have that. And that's a baseline assumption. You have to be great at that. Think of how amazing your impact is, though, if you can do both. Because if you can think through what the organization needs and the capabilities it needs to be successful, and then you can help think at an individual level, like, how do you bring her along in this? How do you make sure that, because she's, if that's a very different approach than she's seen in the past, how do you make sure all people kind of see, like, why we're going to do this and understand how they're connected to it and what role they can play? That's what helps really the change and the acceleration of what you're trying to do from a business side. And I tell people all the time, like, the thing I love about my job the most is I still at this level get to impact at least one person a day, like in an individual way, like something, some conversation we have or something that we put in place that we get a thank you for. And that's like, there's my peers, I don't think have that. Like, that's the unique part about doing this role. As senior as you get, never lose that. Like, the fact that you can have an impact on a person's life, which impacts their whole circle outside of work. Like, it impacts their family, their friends. If someone leaves and feels good about the work they're doing, because we spend so much time doing it, you're really helping their broader circle, because that person is feeling super good about the work they do.
Well, Michael, you've definitely given listeners a lot to think about in this episode, and myself as well, of course. The last question that I have for you is, when you think about kind of your contemporaries and your peers in the space, who inspires you? Who do you kind of look at and look at the kind of teams and people operations groups that they're building and really kind of, you know, point to that as a model for modern HR?
Yeah, there's a few. I mean, I think I'll name particular people, but I think Accenture does really good work just broadly. So I think Ellen Shook, I read a lot of what she does, and I think her work is great. And they have pushed both like fundamentals, but also really progressive practices. I worked under Marcia Abaddon And Marcia is, she's a, when I was at Merck, she's a wonderful leader. And I always felt like she's got the IO psych background and was able to think through progressive practices. And we were doing really early work on data science back then. She's at Ingersoll Rand, but also she's just, she's very much in touch with what people think, what people feel, and how to do that. So I learned a lot under her. And then obviously Laszlo hired me at Google, which people may have hold against him, but I think he was so progressive in the analytics side.
Yeah.
And how to think about that and how to measure sort of in a, especially in a tech way, the he's changed the discipline like full stop. And definitely I think I learned a lot from him and his approach there. So I stay connected in with a number of those folks.
Well, Michael, I really appreciate you taking time out to share your experience, your journey, and your wisdom with me and the listeners. So thanks so much for making time.
No, it was a pleasure, Lars. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of 21st Century HR. If you want to hear more episodes like this or read stories from the 21st Century HR Fast Company series, go to 21stcenturyhr.com. And if you want to make your podcast just a little more awesome, be sure to subscribe to the show on iTunes, Spotify, SoundCloud, or whatever podcast platform your ears desire. You'll find all the subscribe links on the website. And if you enjoy the podcast, do me a favor and share it with your peers, your network, your boss, and your CEO. Help me get the podcast into the ears of anyone who wants to know what HR and recruiting looks like when done really well. They'll thank you for it, and so will I. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next episode.